Okay, folks. Hello. Welcome back. Supervision 2. Thank you for those who have put notes on the Padlet. And I there were a couple of other ones who added one or quite detailed ones by email, but also a couple of general ones which I've transferred to this. So I think we have a number of things we can usefully talk about. I think there's a fairly natural order here, which is, I think I can talk about this, the time of geodesics first. I think this question is one of detail. I'll mention that in a moment. This one and this one, I think, are linked. So I think I'll talk about that. This question, C12, that is a fairly... It's slightly a turning the handle exercise. Part of the payoff of that exercise is more familiarity with component manipulation and so on, and the idea of components in different frames. There aren't any magnificent epiphanies available there, but it is really useful practice. However, it is fiddly, and it's easy to get lost. And the notes, the sort of answer / notes that I have in the in all exercise compendium says, and as you will see, the answer. So it is a little bit vague. So I think I do need to, and someone else pointed that out as well, I think I do need to go and expand that somewhat. So I'll defer discussion of that question there until I get around to making an expanded version of that note. So I think, therefore, the useful thing would be to talk about that. Oh no! I said we're going to talk about that first. This business of the time-like. So where we were there was the time-like geodesics of the local space-time, and the picture. What do we here? Where is this? Oh yes. If we go instead to here, the. The picture I want you to have in mind there is this one here, a particle at rest in an inertial frame, which is a geodesic in Minkowski space. Now, that sort of makes sense, I hope, but this question of time-like geodesics in Minkowski space sort of leaps out of nowhere, to some extent. So where did that come from? If you think back to your study of special relativity, you will doubtless at some point remember the twins paradox. That's where someone stays on Earth and someone else heads off to another planet and comes back, and they end up younger than the person who stayed put. You remember that. That's... familiar, is it, more or less? It's just that diagram there. So all it is the idea of a Minkowski diagram, and the idea that of a world line which is going along the time axis. And if you think of the twins paradox, then if you draw that story, if you like, on a Minkowski diagram, then someone stays on Earth, so they just stay at x equals zero for the entire duration, and someone else heads off at some speed to a turning around point and then comes back, and the traveller and the stay-at-home person end up being different ages. Why? And there's various ways you can talk about this. One of them is to note that because of the way that the interval works out, the invariant intervals ds squared equals dt squared minus dx squared, the interval along the time-like but not time axis, the these paths here is shorter, is smaller than the interval along the direct route. In other words, there's less proper time elapses, therefore, in other words, that person ends up younger. Because that's one way of just slicing right through the total twins paradox and seeing why the person moving is younger. We're just talking about special relativity here. But you can make what happens here is that this straight line here is longer than the dogleg line, which is the opposite way around to Euclidean space. In Euclidean space, the straight line between two points is the shortest distance between two points. And if you look at that a bit more and think through it, you can deduce fairly straightforwardly that in Minkowski space, a straight line is the longest distance between two points. So a straight line in Minkowski space is the longest distance. In other words, it's the extremal distance. And if you recall what I said about geodesics, one of the properties of geodesics is they are the extremal distance between two points. That's the definition one of the definitions of a geodesic. In Euclidean space, that's demonstrably true because if you take a bit of string and you pull it taut, you have discovered the shortest distance between those two points, and that's a straight line. If on the surface of a sphere you pull a string taut, then it forms a great circle. The shortest distance. In Minkowski space, the straight line is the longest distance. It's a geodesic. So the person going along, the stay-at-home person here, they were the person who's just moving, whose world line moves along their own time axis. They're the one following the geodesic. So the point of this is we have identified what geodesics are in Minkowski space. And this person here, the traveller, is also following a geodesic because they are following the time axis in their own inertial frame. So time-like straight lines, if you like, are the geodesics in Minkowski space. And what the equivalence principle tells us is that, okay, we understand how motion works in Minkowski space, special relativity, we move along, our geodesic is moving along the time axis of some inertial frame. And the equivalence principle says the same is true in GR. So in GR, the description of how you move is you move along the time-like geodesics of a local inertial frame. Because the local inertial frame, the free fall frame, is the one which is the same as Minkowski space. So that's why that's why it's significant. This diagram that's the point of this argument here, because we understand how physics works in special relativity, we can immediately transplant that to an understanding of how physics works in the local inertial frame, and because we can always identify the local inertial frame at any point, we just jump up and down. We understand how motion works infinitesimally around a particular point, and thus by iterating that up, we understand how motion works in a non-infinitesimal displacement in our curved spacetime. So this is the first application, if you like, of the equivalence principle in GR, importing a bit of physics from special relativity. And I think that this is quite a nice way of thinking about that, because it harks back to something you're quite familiar with, I think, from special relativity. Overcomplicating this, or talking too much, or this?
How can geodesics have different properties in different spaces? How can you say that in Minkowski, the longest distance is geodesic, we know that...
Because of the minus sign.
But in the sphere, the shortest distance is
geodesic. Yes, but the sphere, on the surface of a sphere, L squared is equal to d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared with a plus sign. So if you think about the calculus deviations, the calculus variations, then any what that is telling you, that what that plus sign is telling you, is that any deviations from a straight line are going to increase this length. Whereas in this case, any deviations from a straight line delta x squared being non-zero, or delta sigma squared, whatever, are going to decrease that thing. So it's this. So the answer is the sign. And the signature. So the signature of the surface of a sphere is the same as the signature, so-called, of Euclidean space, which is all positive. And the signature of special relativity, special relativity's metric, is plus minus minus minus, which is the same as the signature of all of general relativity's metrics. So all the solutions of Einstein's equations are plus minus minus minus, or minus plus plus plus, depending on your convention. But they are a plus two or minus two. And all the solutions of general relativity's, all the solutions of Einstein's equations in general relativity, all the solutions that describe the universe have the same signature because they are all mappable to the Minkowski space one. And so, so other signatures are possible. Mathematicians care about those. As physicists, we only care about signatures which are plus, minus, 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 or minus, plus, or plus. Question there.
Do you mean both of the twins move along the geodesics?
Who does?
Both of the twins.
Yes, so they are both moving along a geodesic in their frame.
So do you mean all the inertial frame for special relativity is moving along the geodesics?
Yes, so because, I said in inertial frame, so in each of these cases, something like that's the T prime axis. That, from there to there, is also a geodesic, but that's a space-like geodesic. So all of the straight lines in Minkowski space are geodesics, and because of the way the special relativity works, it turns out that there is always a frame in which the traveller, say, is not moving in their frame. So where's my Padlet? How do you go to tab? Control tab? Okay. So that was what this was about. How do you go from application to application in Windows? Oh, there you go. Is that, that's not the right page, is it? Ah, right. Did that illuminate? Okay. I think this is a good question to look at. It's essentially the comma goes to semicolon rule in the case of equation 420, I think it was. So what we're looking at here was. And I'll just talk through this rather than writing about it much. How do I make this bigger? Let's search up. Here. So the way we get to this expression here is we're doing this calculation in a local inertial frame. So we're doing this calculation in the frame which is locally flat, and in which the first derivative of the metric, so the metric is the Minkowski metric, diagonal plus minus minus minus, and the first derivatives of the metric are all zero, and when we do that, we discover equation 419 that the Riemann derivatives of the Riemann tensor are that they're both third derivatives of the metric, based on the expression we had for the Riemann tensor in terms of the metric in the local inertial frame earlier on, a couple of equations back. And from that equation 419, we can then play some games late into the night and discover that there's this particular combination of permutations of the Riemann, of the components of the Riemann tensor, is an identity. There are various things cancel out. So that there, the alpha beta are the same in these three cases, and the mu nu lambda cyclically permute in the other three terms. Okay, so that is our deduction, a fiddly, but not deeply intellectually challenging deduction from the expression we had earlier on in the a few things back for the Riemann tensor in terms of derivatives of the metric. But this is only true in the local inertial frame. So we calculated this in the local inertial frame, so it's true in the local inertial frame. Are we stuck in the local inertial frame? No, we are not. Because this involves just single derivatives. And in the local inertial frame, one of the key property of the local inertial frame is that all the gammas, all the Kronecker deltas, all the Kronecker, all the Christoffel symbols, all the gammas are all zero, because the local inertial frame is flat, and the coordinates, the basis vectors in the local inertial frame, don't rotate, if you like, as you move around the space. So that means that if we were to calculate what the covariant derivative of the Riemann, of these components of the Riemann tensor was, then we would, and I got something like this. So we wrote that down and asked, okay, what is that? How do we evaluate that? Well, in the local inertial frame, all the Kronecker deltas are, Kronecker deltas, all the Christoffel symbols are zero. So the expression for what this covariant derivative is, semicolon mu, would be comma mu plus Kronecker delta Christoffel symbol, the gamma, blah, blah, blah. So it would turn into this. So if we calculated that in the local inertial frame, we get this, and we get the answer zero. So there's a question there. So in getting to from 419 to 420, what you do is it just write that whole thing out, and lots of things would just cancel. So you get there just by algebra. It's just fiddly, and you'd get all the things wrong. The question is what's the smart move, the sneaky little move that gets you from there to there. And it is that when you evaluate that in the local inertial frame, it turns into that. In other words, you can go in the other direction. And you can say, if we found this in the local inertial frame, then it would also be the case that we'd have this, because these two things would evaluate to the same thing in the local inertial frame. But this is a tensor equation. And so if it's true in the local inertial frame, if those components have that relationship in the local inertial frame, then when you switch back to a non-inertial frame, this tensor equation would still be true. And this is one of the, if you like, two comma goes semicolon rules that you are exposed to. There's this one, which is the mathematical trick, which is it involves you getting out of the local inertial frame. And the other one is the equivalence principle, which says that if you have a law expressed in geometrical form in special relativity, where the covariant derivative is just the same as the ordinary derivative, just comma, then there's nothing more complicated in going to the equal general relativity. So there's another remark about the stuff about the time-like geodesics. And a physical law expressed in geometrical form in special relativity turns into the corresponding one in general relativity. The comma in special relativity turns into the semicolon in general relativity. And that's also called the comma goes semicolon rule. But there's two different things happening there. This one is a mathematical trick. The other one is a physical statement that you're allowed to do that. And nothing else, there are no extra terms that appear because of curvature and the like. Does that make sense?
So, my only
No. I mean, that would take you an afternoon to go through all the yeah. In some quarters, it is a useful exercise to say, be able to derive such and such. It's sort of useful. It obliges people to think through the notes and so on. But most of the things in relativity, I never think that's terribly useful as an exercise anyway, as an assessment thing. But in most cases in general relativity, it's just infeasible in an exam because it just takes too long. Writing exam questions for GR is murder, because anything is either trivial or an afternoon's work to calculate. And so finding things in the middle which are not just insulting to you, but which are still doable in a reasonable amount of time without panic is tricky. Share my pain. I hate it. I actually mind marking less. Okay, that was... So that's sort of this bit. Another thing is useful to... I'll come back to that. Useful to look at the 329. 329? Was it here? Which was this one? I think this was also a useful thing to talk through. I'll make that a bit bigger. So, in a previous exercise, you calculated the Christoffel symbols for the surface of the unit sphere, and it's just asking you to, at that point, turn the handle and calculate the components of the coverage centre in these coordinates. So, back in exercise 3.4, we got... I'll even write them down on this bit of paper. 324, just for reference in a moment. So, we had g theta equals 1, g phi equals sine squared theta. Of the zero, and the because that's diagonal, the components of the inverse metric, the metric with indices raised is just 1/ those, because those two matrices are diagonal. And the Christoffel symbols we worked out one may have worked out in that, where if there's a nice neat table of them, yes there is, that gamma theta phi is equal to minus sine theta cos theta, gamma phi theta phi, which equal to phi phi theta, equals sine theta, and was there another one? Theta, and I think the other ones were all zero. Yeah. Zero. Thank you. So that's that. I'm just copying exercise 324 at that point. So calculate the components of the coverage sensor for these coordinates. So what's R in this case? And what we know is that R, the Riemann tensor is, I think it's 349. If I've got the right place, 340. Is this? So it's a fairly messy thing which involves the Christoffel symbols and derivatives of them. So if we ask, if we pick one of the components of the Riemann tensor, I think what I'm picking here is R theta phi, then that's going to be G theta alpha R alpha phi theta phi. So that so for instance this and we obtain that by doing that contraction. And looking back at equation D49, that's going to be G theta alpha. Right, this is going to be tedious. Gamma alpha phi comma theta minus gamma I, is it alpha? Phi theta comma phi plus alpha. Why don't I just copy that down rather than trying to do it? Sigma phi phi minus alpha sigma phi sigma theta phi theta. So all I'm doing here is looking back at this expression here and sort of filling in the filling in the slots, and I get a bit of a mess. But I can do the alpha summation immediately, very quickly, because we know that G theta phi is zero, and G theta is one. So the sum there where alpha is equal to phi is zero, and what we're left with is just that expression there with alpha turned into theta. So we have theta phi phi comma theta minus theta phi theta comma phi plus sigma phi phi minus theta sigma phi theta. And now we look back at this expression here, and we discover that theta phi phi. 324. Come on, where's 324? Theta, yeah. Okay. The theta phi phi d theta is going to be minus cos squared theta plus sine squared theta. Theta phi theta is zero because it's one of the others that are zero. Theta something theta is going to be zero for any sigma because it's one of the others that are zero. Theta something phi is going to be non-zero only if when sigma is equal to phi, so that's the only term that will survive from the sum, and that will be minus gamma theta phi 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 theta, which is equal to theta phi phi is minus sine theta cos theta times cos theta over sine theta. That gives us a cos square theta, a minus cos square theta, so that cancels with that. We end up with sine squared theta. I'm rather impressed I got that. I didn't make a sign error there. I'm majorly impressed, actually. But the point, even if I had made a sign error, then the point of this looks rather more forbidding. The thing that needs practicing here, the thing that something like that size is the sort of thing that I think would be is the sort of thing that would fit in an exam question. That's not a promise. But that's the sort of size of thing that fits in an exam question, and it's easy if you've practiced them, and you've failed, so you've managed to avoid just losing track and getting an explosion of signs all over the place. The practice comes in saying, I spot that zero, so I don't have to do anything else. That's zero for all the possibilities of sigma. This one is. Is non-zero only when sigma is equal to phi, so identifying which terms survive the sum and just keeping track of the algebra. So a nice easy question, nice few marks if you have practiced it, because it's easier to understand than to do on the hoof, as it were. But that's only one of the components of the Riemann tensor. There are or 2 by 2 by 2 by 2. There are 8 components of the Riemann tensor. So what are the other ones? Well, that was r theta phi. But we know from the symmetries of the Riemann tensor that were noted down that is equal to minus r theta phi theta, where we've just swapped over the last two terms. It's equal to minus r phi theta phi, where we've swapped over the first two, and it is equal to swapping over the first pair and the second pair, but that just gets back what we started off with. What I'm looking at there are these things here. So the symmetries of the Riemann tensor, which are obtainable from this expression in the local inertial frame, which is and that expression there is not we can't turn the commas into semicolons in that case. Can anyone see why not? In this case here, why can we not just turn those commas into semicolons? It's not about geodesics. It's because they're second derivatives. Because that is not an obvious remark, but these are second derivatives of the metric. So if you think of what the G, J, K, semicolon, M, K would be, it would involve terms which were comma, M, comma, K, plus derivatives of the Christoffel symbols as well. And they don't and the derivatives of the Christoffel symbols don't necessarily disappear, so that by itself is not the local inertial frame version of a covariant derivative. But this one here, we can use that to calculate these symmetries here, because these symmetries don't involve any covariant derivatives at all. They are tensor equations again, even though we calculated them in the local inertial frame. And so, being tensor equations, we can say they are true in an arbitrary frame. But that's a long way of pointing out that these particular index swaps give us information about what the other things are here. And if we look at something like R theta phi phi, we can know that changes sign if we swap the last two indexes. So that is equal to minus r theta theta phi phi, and which means that of course it has to be zero. So although there are two times two times two times two components of the Riemann tensor on the surface of a sphere in two dimensions, most of them are equal. Some of them are zero. The only one we have to actually calculate is a sample one, a sample non-zero one, which we do by doing this relatively simple, once you get used to it, sum. Does that make sense? So in a way, let's go back to exercise 3.29. In a way, there's slightly less to that exercise than meets the eye. It looks sort of forbidding, but it's actually quite a useful exercise to go through step by step. And you've seen me do this here. Go off and do that again. From a standing start and rehearse that sort of thing. It's just a matter of index gymnastics. Did that hang together as a set of thoughts? Okay, a question there.
We did there,
but when we summed that over alpha, that was with alpha equals theta, and that was alpha equals phi, but the g theta theta is 1, and g theta phi is 0, so the second term with alpha equals phi is, you know, this is something, but it multiplied by 0, so it just disappeared. So that's how we got from there to there. That is the answer to that sum. Again, something that's really obvious once you've worked through it by hand once. Were there more to that exercise? I think was there a sort of codicil to that exercise? Why would you not use equation 355? Yes. So this expression here looks like it's a shortcut to what we calculated there, but that applies only in the local inertial frame. Which is sort of the tangent to the. In this context, that applies only to the tangent to the surface of the sphere, but what we want is the Riemann tensors on the surface of the sphere. So you had a waving answer there, more is adding to the Padlet as I speak. Speak faster. Oh, thank you. Right, good. That was an evil question. So this, I think that's a natural move on to what the Ricci tensor and scalar mean. And I think that this naturally follows on because so the rest of that question 329 had us calculate what the Ricci tensor was in the space in these coordinates r theta theta equals 1 r phi phi equals sine squared theta, and now I'm afraid I'm going to give you a slightly hand-waving answer to this question. What do these things mean? Because physically, I think I should be able to find a sort of deeper way of saying this. But if you look at those expressions, then what you can see is that's not a very pretty that's going to be phi, and so that is going to be theta. What is and that's going to be theta. So if you look at thicker spherical polars, then the fact that as you change phi, as you change theta, as you change the sort of longitude, the azimuthal coordinate, the sort of volume element, the area element at that point is proportional to the change in proportion to the size to the change you make in d theta. But as you change phi, as you open up that angle, the area element in that little block there changes in proportion to the sine of this angle here. So what the Ritchie tensor is picking up is the sort of sensitivity, if you like. What just popped into my mind is the sensitivity of this area element to the changes in depending on where in the coordinates in the coordinate surface you are. So it's another slightly hand-waving way. I think the Ritchie tensor is giving you information about the way the coordinates change as you move around the space, in a way that's useful for the sort of calculation. The Riemann tensor is giving you more information about exactly how a vector will change, all its components will change, as you go in a circuit in a space. But the Ritchie tensor is sort of summarising that to the sort of need to know bits for doing calculations on the surface of the sphere, in a way. So there's more in the Riemann tensor than you sort of need for calculations. And the Ritchie tensor is the encoding the behaviour of the coordinates as you move around. And in this case, so the way we calculate that is the way we calculate that is by saying r theta is equal to going to be g. Alpha, how do I write this? So R G L is equal to G I K R I G K L. So R theta is going to be G, let's say alpha beta R alpha theta beta theta, and that will only be which will be equal to G theta R theta plus G phi r phi theta, and since that is equal to zero, that is equal to g one over sine squared theta times sine squared theta equals one. That's how we calculated these, and the curvature tensor, I'm not going to go through it. Similarly, ends up, it's a curvature scalar, similarly ends up being a number, which is constant over the whole surface of the space. So the sphere has a constant curvature, the same curvature at every point. The behaviour, the sensitivity of an area element to the position on the sphere varies as you move over the sphere in ways that this picks up. But the overall curviness of the sphere is the same everywhere. The units of that curvature are not particularly interesting, but.
So, like, if you have a space that changes curvature, then R would not be constant.
Yes, an ellipsoid, for example. Yeah. So, say you did this with the surface of an ellipsoid.
Yeah.
Then there R would have a probably a variation on depending on the theta parameter. Yeah, so that would be a coordinate dependence to the curvature. Yeah. Okay, so talk faster. Right, I think I'm not going to mention that just now because that section 413 is the alternative way of getting the energy momentum tensor, which I isn't a dangerous bend thing, but which I sort of wanted to give a sort of body swerve to. I can pick that up in an office hour if anyone wants to grab me next Thursday. I think I said next Thursday. This point here is picked up by the stuff in part 4, which is 4. Yeah, I mean, the stuff in 413 is quite nice, but I want to think of it, and it's quite nice. I don't want to put a dangerous bend thing there to discourage you from having a look at it, but I sort of don't want you to spend too much time on it. What I said back here was this thing here. So the question was the right the audio component, blah blah blah. What am I saying? So I think this is essentially. It'd be useful to where's it gone? To go through this argument again. Trying to recall the steps just before this. So the it essentially comes from rearranging this this version of the components in this frame here. So the row comes about from the consideration of the dust. So the energy momentum in this box just sitting there moving forwards into time is dependent on just how much mass there is, just how much material there is, in the case of dust. Dust, remember, is this idealized thing which isn't moving. There's a frame in which it isn't moving, so there's no contribution to the energy momentum from that. There's no internal shears, it's a perfect fluid. There's no internal stresses and strains. And because it's not moving inside the box, it's not banging off the edge off the side of the box, so it's not creating any pressure in the box. So the only source of energy momentum in that notional box is due to the mass density moving forward into the future. And that's where the T00 component comes from. At just essentially the energy density in the box, which is in this context the same as mass density. And this question of why the energy momentum tensor is proportional to the unit matrix is, and I have to find a better way of explaining this, because one of these things that when you it sort of feels right, but I'm not sure how I would go through the steps to expand on it. If there isn't a preferred direction, then that tensor has to be rotationally symmetric. If there's no shear, then there can't be any contributions to energy momentum which depend on something moving in this direction across a plane in a different physical plane, and so you can the explanation I should tie down a little more. Fundamentally, it's the rotational symmetry of that situation means it has to end up being diagonal, and so if you got that far, then the rest is just sort of algebra, in the sense that you can expand that, or you know, add and subtract this matrix here, turn that into something which is purely time like. I think I've got at least one question, two questions. So this, we've just, because we've taken that out into two matrices, added a P here and subtracted a corresponding P there, purely so that this is then proportional to the metric. So that ends up being P times the metric. And in the local inertial frame, that ends up being proportional to T times the velocity flow vector in that frame. Therefore, we can write this as, and in that frame, in the local inertial frame, the we discover we can write this. So we can write down this in the local inertial frame, and because at that point local inertial frame, the instantaneously co-moving reference frame, and because the tensor equation in that frame is a tensor equation everywhere. So that's that's actually quite a lot happening in that paragraph. There's a couple of paragraphs. There's a certain amount of physics motivated seat of the pants hand waving, combined with a certain amount of, you know, slight cunning in splitting this up the right way, combined with identifying the fact that in this more entirely co-moving reference frame, these vectors take a nice simple form, combined with turning this into a matrix, therefore turning it into a matrix, tensor equation in that local co-moving reference frame, at which point you realise that once you've written down a tensor equation, you've written it down quite generally. So there are a number of different steps using using everything from physics to, you know, dumb algebra in that passage. Which would be quite... Yes. No, if it's a tensor equation, it's geometric, so it can't be frame specific. The components might be worked out in a frame, but the tensor equation, because it's purely talking about geometry, is frame independent, has to be frame independent. So, okay, that was more talking than I braced myself for, but I'll see you. The last lecture is on Wednesday, so I shall look forward with eager anticipation to seeing your bright, shining faces there.